Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
I'm not here.
Derek's not here right now. You're on vacation.
But we're going to pretend I'm here.
Yes, Derek's not here. I've just gotten so good at being his voice.
Yes.
For all these years, it's actually just been me.
Yes.
Pretending to be Derek. It's actually only been one person here all the time.
It's funny, though, that you do my voice in a much cooler way than you do your own voice.
Right? So it's just because I don't want people to know who I really am. Suave.
You make me
debonair.
Make me sound better than you. Good job.
I make you sound handsome, fella.
Anyway, yes, I'm on vacation.
You are on vacay.
In the Maritimes. As this posts, I should be...
almost home.
Either in Digby or St. John.
Well, if you're in Digby, I hope you're whale watching.
We're the ferry, as I'm on it right now, as people are listening, very expensive. $335 to cross.
From Digby to St. John?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you got your vehicle and everything and four people.
I know. It's expensive.
And how much would gas be?
Well, it would be a 6.5 hour drive around.
It would have been cheaper.
It would have been cheaper.
Gas-wise.
Gas-wise. It would be cheaper gas-wise.
But
it's the 6.5 hours plus stops, plus lunch, plus yada, yada, yada.
Plus whining kids.
Yeah, yeah. So... And you practically, the way the roads go, unless you take side roads, you're practically going all the way back into Halifax again, and then up to Moncton, and then back down to St. John, and so it's like, yeah.
How are you getting there? Are you taking the ferry across from St. John to...
No, we're crossing at Truro, Nova Scotia.
Okay, because there's the old farmer's cheese.
You mean to pick up some cheese?
They had Dragon's Breath blue cheese.
Yeah.
And we picked some up when we were there a number of years ago.
Well, we'll have to mark down some
details. Yeah, I'll have to get you that information. But it was actually good. It was actually good good cheese. But he's got it. It's his farm, and he makes all this different types of cheese. So you're going to Google that now.
I am. I'm there now, so I should check.
So, yeah, you're there now. You may as well just stop on in and
buy remember the name of the place?
Buy some cheese. Yeah, the old farmer's cheese or something like that. I'll have to take a peek for it and let you know. But, yeah, so you're zipping around. You're doing the Maritimes, Nova
yes.
Scotia and New Brunswick.
Yeah, so New Brunswick,
Bay of Fundy?
Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, it's all Nova Scotia, but I always see it as separate.
Yeah.
So Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, cruise down around, and going to check out the town where my grandma was born and raised, Metigan, Nova Scotia, and then you're going to be doing a lot of hikes. We're hitting a lot of like Kushipaquak and Kejimkujik National Parks and a bunch of other stuff. There's a couple of really cool Airbnbs we're staying in.
Are you going to have your canoes with you?
No, it's just...
Kejimkujik is great for paddling.
Yes, but we could always rent. It's not worth the wind drag and the security issues of...
Yes, it is.
No, you rent. Just rent.
Blasphemy. I will be looking while you are away for different hosts. No, yeah, are you gonna try to get out?
We're
going to
try and get out for some paddling. Absolutely. Yeah. It depends on what's available. Like we know that there's a couple of places where we're staying that have canoe rentals. So we'll look at them when we're there, depending on the weather and the time and how much time we have. Because there's going to be more driving than anything, right?
Are you going to do the tidal bore raft?
You mean reversing falls or
rafting? Tidal bore.
So yeah. I thought about that. It's we were going to do it if we didn't take the ferry. So we would spend a day up at the top there and wherever and do the tidal bore. We thought about it. I thought about, you know, if we could. I've been watching videos of things to do. Mm-hmm. And so I watched a video of somebody surfing up the tidal bore. And it would be really cool, really worth it, I think. But it depends on timing.
Timing and cash.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything's
This is very expensive.
Money. Yeah. Money. But.
Yeah. One of the Airbnbs we're staying is a treehouse Airbnb. It's very cool.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, it's nice.
Haven't you had enough concussions?
Exactly. So,
what happened to Derek? Well, we were in a treehouse. We had to use the bathroom.
Climbed the stairs. He had a heart attack. Fell. Another concussion.
Yeah.
When he landed, it restarted his heart.
Yeah. He thought that there was, you know, there were stairs. He missed the stairs. Fell through the hole 20 feet to the bottom of the tree.
It's very, very cool, though, the treehouse.
That'd be cool.
There's a couple really neat places we're staying, like the Maitland Cottages up in the north end of Cape Breton. So we're going to spend a couple days there. So that's really cool. It's beach-like. So there's a lot of stuff that it's going to be really fun. There's one of the, we're camping as well. One of the campsites looks out over
St. Lawrence Seaway comes out there.
Yeah, the Seaway does.
Uh-oh, he's having problems. He's having issues now.
Gulf of St. Lawrence. Good God.
It's the Gulf of St. Lawrence.
Yes.
Same thing.
Yeah.
We know what you're talking about. Yeah.
But yeah, so we're going to do a lot of hiking. A lot of hiking.
Excellent.
Try not to get trampled by moose.
Yeah.
Eaten by wolves.
Squished by walruses and whales.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. You got to. Have the kids seen whales? Been out on a whale cruise?
No.
Take them.
We had Stella out when she was 11 months old on a iceberg tour, and the guy stopped the boat and snapped off a chunk of ice and brought it on board, and everybody got to eat, you know, 10,000-year-old ice. So that was kind of cool. Yeah. Different.
Yeah.
So. Weird.
Oh, hope you have a good time.
Yeah.
Hope you're having a good time.
Yeah, exactly, because I'm there right now.
Because you're there right now. The Dutchman's Cheese Farm, located in Upper Economy, Nova Scotia, near Truro.
Oh, okay. Passed right through there.
Right? See? The Dutchman's, that Dutchman's Cheese Farm. Yeah, we went in there. They had a whole bunch of different types of cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, oh, this is tasty.
Cheeses.
Artisanal cheeses. Specialize in artisanal cheeses made from raw milk following a tradition that dates back centuries.
Well, there you go.
So there you go. Let's talk about other stuff now. A Meteo tsunami is a large tsunami-like wave that is generated by atmospheric disturbances rather than seismic activity and earthquakes. So we're going to get all science-y here today. These waves are caused by rapid changes in atmospheric pressure, often associated with fast-moving weather events like thunderstorms, squalls, and storm fronts. While traditional tsunamis are caused by seafloor movement, Meteo tsunamis are a result of atmospheric pressure changes that displace water, creating a wave that can propagate and in some cases become amplified along coastlines. I'm thinking Meteo is from meteorologic.
Yes, that's what I was. Right. My guess was too.
Yeah. So at the beginning of June, end of June, when we were having all those thunderstorms and tornadoes and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Again, back to last episode, we talked about Ian Parrish and the high winds that he's dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
When you get high temperatures and jet stream and all those things interacting, you end up with big storms.
Things happen. So Alan Auld of Shania, Ontario, which is up near Thunder Bay, Ontario, said he stepped out to look at Lake Superior and was among people who saw the waters receding. Something he compared to the draining of a bathtub. So you got this shoreline, and all of a sudden, the water's going the wrong direction.
Yeah, and your boat is now in the mud, and the dock is down, laying on the mud, and
At first, we joked to everyone saying, who pulled the plug?
And nobody ran. Tsunami!
Right? To see Lake Superior, the largest freshwater lake in the world, can do something like that, that's quite powerful. So we were in awe. On the east border of Thunder Bay, Chenaya is a municipal township along Lake Superior's northern shoreline. The massive fluctuations in water levels have also intrigued multiple scientists who think the area experienced a meteo-tsunami, type of tsunami wave that can cause water levels near shorelines to rise and fall rapidly, not to be confused with the tides.
Exactly.
Which are something completely
different. So it's not tidal, it's not a tsunami from earthquake, it's a meteor, a weather-caused
tsunami. While traditional tsunamis, like you say, are caused by seafloor movement like earthquakes, meteo-tsunamis are linked to fast-moving weather conditions such as thunderstorms.
Yeah.
And like you say, in the last end of June, we're getting massive thunderstorms.
Mm-hmm.
And tornadoes touched down in central Ontario there and caused massive destruction.
Algonquin Park and Sam de Champagne.
A big change in air pressure accompanied with high wind speeds can play into generating a meteo-tsunami wave, says Eric Anderson, an associate professor at the Colorado School of Mines, who has been studying meteo-tsunamis for over a decade. Anderson said researchers are analyzing atmospheric conditions and water level data to figure out what happened. We have enough evidence to say that this was a meteo-tsunami-like event. Meteo-tsunami-like event.
Yeah.
In order to officially confirm it was a meteo-tsunami, I don't think they used the word meteo-tsunami enough in this article.
They need another dozen.
Right? Anderson said researchers need to create a computer model that simulates how the waves move around inside the lake, which will take some time. Ald and others who saw the water fluctuations thought it was a seiche. Now, what's a seiche, you say? Seiche is a standing wave oscillating in an enclosed or partially enclosed body of water, like a bay or a lake. It's essentially the water sloshing back and forth after being disturbed. These waves can be caused by various factors, including strong winds, rapid changes in atmospheric pressure, earthquakes, and even tsunamis, like a meteo-tsunami.
There you go.
Anderson says a seiche, S-E-I-C-H-E, is a standing wave that oscillates, and it's like water slashing back and forth. Lake Superior, the seiche period would last about 8 hours.
It's a giant bathtub.
That's a massive bathtub. Anderson said the event occurred too fast to be a seiche, but was more consistent with a meteo-tsunami. He says meteo-tsunamis are propagating waves that move through the water and have much quicker time frame, lasting minutes to an hour or two. On Saturday, the water level gauges recorded changes of tens of centimeters to a meter on Lake Superior. That's a huge amount of water. This is a big one. It's rare for meteo-tsunami of that scale to happen on Lake Superior. It occurs perhaps a couple of times a decade at most, Anderson says, and while he's not aware of any fatalities or damage, he says the event could have easily resulted in drownings. Could you imagine being out there paddling on a trip? And all of a sudden, because if the water's going down, I got to think it's dragging you out farther too.
Well, there's a couple things. So there's a couple things that they don't talk about, because where did this water go? Somebody has a high water event.
Which they I had would a think low the water. Other side.
Yeah. So then you'd have somebody who was having a high water event with their docks being pushed up on shore, boats being pushed up on shore, whatever. And so there's also, how does the water respond in the middle leg? Is it even noticeable? Mm-hmm. Is it just like, oh, if you were looking at GPS, it's like, huh, the surface of Lake Superior is normally 254 meters above sea level, but now we're 264 meters above sea level. That's weird.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, but it really depends. And if, is that standing wave, is it big enough to notice, or would you really notice it out in the middle of the lake?
But if you're in Lake Superior in a canoe out in the middle.
Okay. I'm talking, I'm talking bigger ships.
That's not your first concern.
You're right. You are too far from land.
You're thinking, if you're like 100 meters off of shore or something, and then all of a sudden that water starts dragging out.
And pulling you out.
It's got to be pulling you out at the same time, right?
Or push you in or something, right? So it'd be wild to be to experience that. So, and I suppose if you had a big enough weather burst, you could see it on smaller lakes too, right? Like Opeongo or who knows what, right? like Killarney, like the Georgian Bay. Like you would think that water pushing that far, you'd have it across. Like let's say if it was Huron and Georgian Bay, like. Yeah, is it big enough and wide enough to cause a media tsunami? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think they would be long enough.
Mm-hmm.
But
Superior is because the dog's head of the Superior is a very large lake.
Yeah.
So you can see where a large wind event could push water from one end of the lake to the other if it was consistent and high enough speeds of wind. So.
Yeah, I think that wind across a big lake like Opeongo and Algonquin. Mm. Would be too fast.
Yeah, I think so.
It wouldn't have time to build up the water.
Yeah, the lake's too small, I think.
Yeah. This is kind of on par with our most catastrophic meteo tsunamis. While rare, it's important for people to be aware of meteo tsunamis because they can be dangerous, says Chin Wu, a professor at University of Wisconsin in Madison, who has expertise in meteo tsunamis. Wu said there have been multiple incidents of meteo tsunamis resulting in fatalities. People on beaches and piers can be swept away during periods of water level fluctuation.
There you go.
Potential dangers are the water levels fluctuating back and forth, particularly once the water levels go up and go down. Once the water level goes down, they will drag the people out of the beaches and cause drownings.
There you go, yes.
So if you were in your canoe, like I say, it would suck you out that way.
Yep. Riptide type.
And then
thing.
You think when it comes back,
is it going to smash into something?
It's got to shoot you back.
Yeah.
Right? So it's just like hang on, enjoy the ride if you're in a boat.
Well,
not so much if you're swimming.
I think, well, they did say the period for Superior is about 8 hours. So you're going to be washed out a couple hundred meters and you paddle back in. And so you're not going to sit there and say, well, I guess we'll wait 8 hours for it to push us back in.
I can be lazy. Yeah, I think if you're in a boat, it'd be one thing. But but they're saying if you're swimming or something.
If you're out swimming,
That's something completely
could
different.
Could be catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. I warn against going to beaches and shorelines amid thunderstorms or rapid changes in water levels. Researchers are still trying to figure out how to forecast when meteo tsunamis might happen. Similar to tornadoes, we want to make sure we can always forecast this kind of dangerous event and warn people ahead of time. So now you know more about the weather stuff and what can happen. Until you sent me this article,
I'd never heard of it either.
Of these meteo tsunamis and seiches. It's like, okay, well, there's just giant thunderstorm. Yeah. And, well, I don't know. See, this is just another reason me and Lake Superior won't get along.
Yeah.
It just adds to it. Yeah. What do I got here? The other side of a rescue.
Yes. And we've talked about this. I don't know that we've talked about it at length, but we have talked about stuff like this before. Every time it comes up, a lot of the comments are like, you're going out and doing stupid things, but now you have to be rescued, and you're risking the lives of the rescuers, right? And so that's always a common argument. I don't always agree about it, because sometimes you're not doing anything risky. You just happen to trip and fall and break a leg or something, you know, untowards happens where you're not putting yourself at risk. It's just stuff happens.
Yeah.
But still, like, you know, the rescuers are potentially putting themselves into a life endangering event. And so that, I think that's where this kind of thing comes in.
When you're out there doing whatever activity you're doing, be it paddling, hiking, camping, rock climbing, whatever, you take the risks. And sometimes, like you say, things happen. It's called an accident because that's what it is. When first responders are needed, they come and do what needs doing. Afterwards, people talk about the person that needed help. How are they now? Will they ever go out there again? What could they have done differently? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what doesn't get talked about a lot is the after effects of the first responders. So in November 2024, and we talked about this, a group was in Tasmania on a kayaking trip on the Franklin River when one man slipped and fell between some rocks. The rest of the group tried to get him out, but his leg was trapped and everything they tried could not dislodge him. They had to call for help. Rescuers arrived. They tried everything to free the man, but in the end, they could not, and a decision was made that they would have to amputate the man's leg in order to free him.
It amazes me that he was trapped so badly. Mm-hmm. Because I thought about this event. We've talked about it before. And for him to, I was thinking, like, if he was in a dry suit, you cut off the leg of the dry suit and you wheedle his leg out of his boot and so on. But he was trapped so badly. Like, he must have really fallen between those rocks to jam in there so tight.
They tried hammering it. They tried airbags
to spread the rock,
nothing worked. They were using ropes, you're thinking of all the things that you would do, and they tried it all and they could not get him unpinned.
It was the point where he was potentially going to die. It's like, we've got to take his leg.
And it's not something you want to think about, right? But like I say, these are the things that really, you know what they did, but you don't hear the stories and the thought processes and the effects on the first responders who had to finally get to the point where they said, this is our only option, and then have to do it.
Somebody has to get in there with a knife and a saw and separate that leg. That's got to be hard on a person.
I wouldn't want that job. So these rescuers have now opened up about their thoughts and feeling on the rescue. So there was interview thing was done. Rescuers have relived the horrific moment they realized they would have to amputate a man's leg to save his life while he was trapped in rapids in a remote part of Australia. Lithuanian Valdis Valdis. Was on a whitewater rafting trip on the powerful Franklin River when he slipped while hopping from one boulder to another, falling chest deep into the icy cold water, jamming his leg in a narrow gap between the boulders. So you figure your leg went straight down, leg comes straight out.
Yeah.
Not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Despite efforts of the others in his group and then later rescuers, nothing they did could get his leg out. After hours of trying, the rescuers realized he would have to lose his leg to leave the river alive.
So I think at that point he was kind of experiencing hypothermia
and
other events.
Yep. It was a big mental hurdle realizing that we were going to cut off his leg. Intensive care flight paramedic Rohan Killam said. But eventually, if it all goes perfectly, he'll never be the same again. But even if it all goes perfectly, he'll never be the same again.
So we'll save his life. But
so this is a life-altering moment that you've got to make for somebody else. After he slipped and fell into the river, his fellow rafter spent 40 minutes trying to lever him out of the gap with a paddle and ropes before calling for help with a satellite phone. As rescuers, including police, paramedics, doctors, arrived at the remote location, they tried everything from airbags, spreaders, a pulley system, and hydraulics to get him out. The rescuer even grabbed me by the waist to haul me up, but my legs wouldn't budge, he says. The hours stuck in the 8 to 10 Celsius water began to take its toll. Despite wearing a wetsuit and regular hot food and drinks, he started to develop hypothermia. Yeah, it was a wetsuit, not a dry suit.
Yeah.
I wonder if that would have made a difference.
Well, it would make sense why he got trapped, because a wetsuit is harder tighter, to get off. Right?
Yeah. I began to think maybe I'm destined to stay here stuck forever. Rescue teams worked through the night to try to get him free of the fast-running water, and Surf Lifesaving Tasmania swift water rescuer Adrian Petrie said they were determined to free him. We knew we were going to get him out. It was how we were going to get him out, Petrie says. By 4 a.m., so this is like 4 a.m. in the morning, yeah, since the day before,
yeah,
all forms of rescue had been attempted, and he was still stuck and continuing to deteriorate. Once rescuers had agreed that their only option was amputation, Lithuanian rafter Arvydas Rudikas had to translate the plan for his fellow kayaker.
Hey, bud, we're going to have to take your leg off.
Valdis asked, so I will become handicapped? Maybe, Valdis, but if not, you will die here in this hole, Arvydas said. Intense. So you got to think, 4 in the morning, after everything that's been done, all that's been, and it comes down to having to tell your buddy.
Yeah.
So the only plan they have left.
It's the only option. You're going to die
is
if we don't take your leg.
If we don't take your leg off. And then having to be the guys to tell the guys, okay, here's what we need to tell your buddy here.
Yeah. I think they were already thinking it a lot sooner than that. It's just finally they came to the decision.
And actually this said it out loud. This is what we're doing.
Because I'm sure behind the scenes they're like, listen, we might have to cut that leg off. You know? So eventually they say, okay, that's it. No other options. We are out of options.
Another rescuer, Adrian Petrie, said Belioskas' demeanor had totally changed as hypothermia set in, necessitating the amputation. I'd never had to hurt someone to save their life, Mr. Petrie said. Tragedy struck a second time when the doctor initially meant to amputate the leg, slipped and fell, breaking his wrist. It meant another doctor had to be flown in, delaying the critical operation by hours. So this is what we're saying. It may just be a simple thing that, okay, we got to go in and rescue this guy, do some, you know, first aid or whatever till we can get him out. But even with the rescuers going in there, the first responders making that trip in, anything can happen. And in this case, the doctor, and then you got to think the consequences of that.
Yeah.
You know, like in this case, it was an accident, but if you're being foolish and putting yourself in these situations, now you have a doctor who's hurt himself.
And recovery time, loss of work.
Right. That sort of stuff, right? So all those patients that he could be helping after today's jaunt, not happening because now he's hurt. And this was just an accident that he slipped and fell on his way to and broke his wrist.
So they had to fly in another doctor. They had to
fly in another one, which took a couple of hours at least. Jorian Kipax ended up being the doctor charged with the fraught procedure. There was a moment, a real sense of, I really, really don't want to do this, he said. But the inevitable consequence of him staying there was death. And that was going to be quite soon. Supported in the water by Surf Lifesaving Tsunami's Nate Welch. He was given ketamine for pain. Dr. Kipak said he had to use ratchet straps as tourniquets and perform the amputation with bare hands as he had to work by feel underwater. Suddenly he came backwards into my arms and I was waiting for a gush of blood, but there wasn't anything, he said. The entire procedure, although felt like a long time to me, only took about 2 minutes. The kind of training that would go into being able to do something like this.
Yeah, on the fly.
Is phenomenal.
It's not like you could prepare for something. You don't practice taking people's legs off
in
water, underwater.
Yeah.
Right? So this was like, they were creating the event all, as they were doing is like, okay, well, you know, pull back the wetsuit and use a ratchet strap to cut off the blood flow. And this is how we're going to cut this. And this is, we're going to saw through there. And
yeah, you know, they've got, you know, like their triage area all set up around
them. Yeah.
So that the minute he's out.
But how far down into that hole did the doctor have to get into?
Right.
Right.
And
because
what if he slipped?
Yeah.
So there's all these little things, right? Like I said, he says it took about 2 minutes. So Dr. Kipax met Biliakis after he awoke from his 4-day coma and was recovering in hospital. He said it was an emotional reunion. I felt like I had to apologize, he said. We both looked at his leg and looked at each other and said, I'm sorry, this is the way it is. Valdis is now back home in Lithuania and said he knew amputation was the right decision. Says, I survived, I'd endured, that's the greatest joy. Now, there's another article they talk about this, and he says that he's actually going to try to go back and finish the trip.
Mm-hmm.
And they never actually said, is the leg still there?
I was thinking the same thing.
That's the one thing you're thinking.
Wait a sec. But you know what? I wonder if it was an option to, okay, they got him out. Were they able to then get the leg out immediately? Like, or was it just a...
Is it just stuck so bad that it's now part of the landscape?
Because you have limited time after an amputation to get things reattached.
Well, that's why I'm saying... Well, I'm...
Because if they couldn't get the leg out and fly it back with them on the same life flight, then...
Yeah.
Then it would still be there. Yeah.
So, yeah, no one's actually ever come out and said that.
Well, I'm sure they recovered it. They had to have. Like, you can't just leave it there.
Why?
For the next paddler going, oh.
Well, no, there'll be a leg stuck there that he won't fall in and get stuck himself. Because now there's a leg blocking that.
They should jam some rocks in that crack.
Yeah, I've not come across any articles that actually said what happened to the
What happened to your leg?
To the leg. Anyway, so yeah, there was a little thing saying that he's going to see about if he can get back and finish that trip.
Yeah.
Want to finish what I started, he said.
So I guess you could still do it for the most part. A whitewater kayaking trip is... So they're out scouting, looking, yada, yada, yada. So he'll have a prosthesis to walk amongst the rocks. It'd be harder to do. But all the work is your upper body.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're scouting. Unless you're walking the rocks.
So you just hang over by the boats. We'll go scout.
Yeah.
And because we don't need none of your shenanigans
again. Yeah. You already messed this up once.
So remember, if something happens out there, it could affect more than just you.
Exactly.
You know, like I say, they talk about, you know, oh, the person did this, the person did that, and how are they doing these days and stuff.
Yeah.
You got to think, there's the other side of the rescue. It's the rescuers themselves, right? The first responders. They've got... You know, I'm sure there's some of these that have, you know, PTSD from some of the stuff they have to do, right? So, so just remember that when you're out there doing foolish things. Dogs. Okay, first off, I'll say, if there was any animal in the world, somebody said, okay, we're going to take you to a zoo or we're going to take you somewhere that has this animal and you get to cuddle with it. Oh. What animal would you choose?
Naked mole rat.
You would. A platypus. Might even be a platypus or a hyena, but a platypus.
I didn't check either. Both can hurt you badly.
Well, a hyena could bite you, but, you know.
A platypus has that poisonous spur.
Yeah, but if he's not sticking you with it, because they look like they'd be all wiggly.
So only the happy platypuses.
The happy platypuses.
Don't hug the angry platypus.
Right. Right. And Perry the platypus. Those who know. But platypuses just look like they would be like a goofy, wiggly...
Greasy, wet...
Like an otter.
Yeah.
An otter with a bill.
A very ugly otter.
Yeah, he's a whacked out otter. He's his cousin. So, dogs.
How do we get from platypuses to dogs?
Oh, I'll connect it. You just hang on.
Just follow the line. Follow the story. Yeah.
So dogs have a sniffer.
Yeah.
So much better than ours. And they've proven dogs can even sniff out like cancer.
Yeah.
Dogs can tell when people are, you know, going to have seizures or
yeah,
that sort of stuff, right? When you think of sniffer dogs, drugs and mm-hmm. stuff like that, your mind goes straight to airports.
Absolutely.
Searching for narcotics to the and to disaster zones, searching for survivals under the rubble. Zoos Victoria's Wildlife Detection Dog Squad.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Using those powerful noses, estimated to be 10,000 to 100,000 times more sensitive to, than a human's, to fight extinction.
Hmm.
The Muttley crew of five dogs and three humans based in Healesville Sanctuary have spent seasons surveying the sanctuary's creek systems to monitor platypus populations.
Hmm.
Hence, the line is now connected.
Yes.
While the elusive monotreme sleeps in burrows, and now they're leveling up. Experienced dogs Kip the Kelpie Cross and Moss the Labrador have been taking the lead on Project Platypus Paddleboard.
So it's a dog on a paddleboard.
It's a dog on a paddleboard.
Finding platypuses.
Finding platypuses.
What's a multiple of platypuses? Platypi?
Well, no, it's a platypus or platypuses.
Not a platypi?
Not a platypi.
So what's a what would be octopi? A herd of platypuses?
A herd?
Yeah.
Well, a swarm?
Yeah.
Well, a gaggle?
What would be the murder crows, a gaggle of geese?
I can't remember what. There is an actual term for it. So taking a cue from detection dogs that sniff out whale scat at sea, the team is now hitting the water on paddle boards to search for platypuses in hard-to-reach habitats. Wildlife Detection Dog Officer Dr. Latoya Jameson said the paddle boards allow them access to trickier locations, which increase the valuable data they can provide to platypus researchers. Did you find it?
It's called a paddle.
A paddle of platypuses?
Yes, it's a how perfect.
Right? Paddle of platypuses, paddling dogs, paddle dogs, paddleboard dogs looking for paddles of platypuses.
A cuddle of puppies, a waddle of penguins, or a paddle of platypus.
Awesome. The data provides a fuller picture on how the species is using the waterway informing future conservation decisions. It has allowed our team greater flexibility in the locations we survey with the dogs and reduced the risk of the dogs encountering snakes sunning themselves on creek banks. So rather than having the dog run along the creek bank,
get bit by a snake.
And get bitten by a snake, which, you know, nobody likes to be bitten by snakes. And it's Australia, so chances are it's going to kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah, the new non-invasive survey technique is also fun and games with the team amping up their exercise routine. Kip and Moss need to use a lot of balance and core strength to search from paddle boards, so it was important that we build up these core muscles on dry land first. Gradually, when the dogs were comfortable, we introduced them to working from the water. I don't think they paddle, though.
No, they don't contribute.
Standing on their back legs. Doodly-doot. The entire team goes through a fit-to-work conditioning program developed at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center. Our communication with the dogs has needed to develop too. Typically, the dogs can search freely and decide where they go, whereas now their movement is restricted and they rely on their handlers to move the board through the search area to detect odor. It is paramount that the handlers are learning to closely read the dog's behaviors. Effective communication and the bond between dogs and humans are the cornerstone of success for this survey method. So you gotta, like, they stand up on the board and, like, point, like a compass, and just sort of move.
Maybe, I guess.
Left, they'd, right.
There'd be other signals.
Go that way!
This way, Scooby.
Zoos Victoria Wildlife Detection Squad Dog Squad was established in 2019 to support field researchers locate cryptic threatened species and their traces such as scat. The dogs are trained to search steadily and alert to their target at a distance, which ensures the animals are not disturbed. Squad focuses on the relationship between humans and dogs forged over thousands of years, applies the latest scientific advances in animal training, husbandry, and welfare. They work closely with Zoos Victoria's 27 local priority threatened species, and the team is grateful to the multiple partners, program contributors, and generous philanthropists who make this conservation work possible.
Very cool.
How cool is that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're taking your dog out on the river. Nope, we're going searching for platypuses.
It's a working day.
Right?
I have to go to work now, and me and my dog are going to go on a paddleboard.
Yeah. Oh, you and your dog, what do? Oh, we check for bombs at the airport. What about you and your dog? Eh, we cruise the river on a paddleboard looking for platypuses.
Equally dangerous.
Equally dangerous. We're trying to avoid the snakes and the gators and big spiders and... How cool is that, though?
That's very cool. That would be neat.
Like, could you imagine that? Like, all of a sudden, whoop, dogs, oh, there's a platypus, and there's a platypus.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be good. And you got to be able to train the dog not to chase it.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Just detect.
Just detect.
Not here to catch.
And like I say, they can sniff and smell them. I mean, you're smelling the platypus poop.
Yeah, yeah. Doesn't mean the platypus is there.
But you know they're in the area.
Yes.
Which is cool, because now that you know they're there... You can
sort zero it in.
Zero in and cordon that off to say this is a conservation area because there's endangered animals here.
Yeah.
Cool. That is cool. The Mackenzie River.
Yes.
Tyrone Yukon says he learned from an elder in Delaney that if you want to get to know the land, you've got to walk the land.
100%.
Canoe is similar to that, he says. You're right up against the land. You're seeing everything. You're not just whizzing by on a motorboat. Yukon is one of 9 Canadian rangers from the Northwest Territories, Yukon and Nunavut, who are spending part of this summer patrolling the Mackenzie River. A total of 12 rangers and other members of the Canadian Armed Forces are paddling the river from Fort Providence all the way to Tuktoyaktuk, where it flows into the Arctic Ocean. Another member of the patrol, Nico Helm from Carcross, Yukon, said he joined the Canadian Rangers when he was 18 years old. I would always hear stories from the rangers. I knew a lot of them from my local town. A lot of the patrol, said Helm, who is now 32, and my mom is also a ranger. So I'd hear all about her trips and always wanted to join. It's like a family business sort of thing. It's pretty cool. Helm said this is his first time paddling the Mackenzie River. I've mostly done small lakes back home, small rivers, short distances, so this is huge, he says. Adding he's looking forward to seeing the scenery and camping out with other rangers. The first Canadian Ranger Patrol Group launched its canoes from Fort Providence and are expected to reach Tuktoyaktuk around August 10th. Captain Gordon Hart said the patrol group has not paddled the Mackenzie River as a unit since before COVID-19 pandemic. The Rangers, they act as guides and advisors for the Army when they come up to the north, and in order for us to do that, we need to have a lot of experience. And so we just need to get out on the land and practice our skills. It's a way to get back out on the river, get to know the river, link back up with all the communities on that river. One thing patrol members are checking is water levels along the Mackenzie River.
Oh, there you go.
The river has experienced historically low water levels in recent years. According to the Northwest Territory government's latest water monitoring bulletin, those levels are still well below average. Hart said his only potential concern with the patrol is wildfires and related smoke. He said he's most looking forward to seeing the San Salt Rapids south of Fort Good Hope. I imagine it's going to be pretty cool with the big cliffs and the noise of the rapids bouncing off those cliffs, he
says. That would be neat.
Wouldn't that be something, just to hear that? But yeah, the rangers are out there and they're back at it and paddling and doing some research, and it's pretty cool. Could you imagine, though, like, finally getting the ability to do that?
Yeah, I know, right? So it's unfortunate they were off the rivers for such a long time, but being back on patrol and you know, protecting our north, it's important.
And you see them on their in the winter with all the skidoos and a bunch of them just zipping across and just checking stuff out. And yeah, like I say, somebody's got to know what's going on up there, and if that's what the Rangers are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Lock and Paddle is back.
Yes. When's the last time that was done?
Last year.
Was it? Yep. So they have been still been doing it.
Oh, yeah. They did it last year. I don't think they did it the year. I think last year was the first year back since COVID. Yeah. Saturday, July 19th. Celebrate Canada Parks Day on the water with hundreds of fellow paddlers at historic sites in Ontario and Quebec. So it used to be just Peterborough at the lift lock.
Yes, traditionally.
On the Trent Severn. Yep. Last year, they added Ottawa and Lachine.
Yes.
They've added those two again this year.
Excellent.
Parks Canada annual lock and paddle event combines color and community as canoes and kayaks from all around descend upon historic canals and waterways for a day like no other. With the Canada Strong Pass this year, enjoy free lockage and make the most of this incredible opportunity. Get your friends and family together, decorate your vessel, and come take part in the story you'll be telling for years to come. Now, we did the nighttime one, the first nighttime one that they did. So we had lights on our canoe, and as did everybody else. And we were at the Peterborough Lift Lock, and the two tubs were just packed. Mm-hmm. And everybody had lights and decorated canoes and whatnot. Yeah. And it was pretty cool.
I saw a picture of that. I was there for one of them, but it was during the day. I wasn't there for the night one.
Yeah, we went for the night one. That was pretty cool. Three different locations to participate this year. The Trent Severn Waterway Peterborough Lift Lock, the Rideau Canal at Hartswell Lock, and the Lachine Canal in Montreal at St. Gabriel Lock. The Peterborough Lift Lock, 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. Plan ahead. Decide where you will launch your canoe from. Now, that's the thing with all these places is there's so many people that come to these, especially Peterborough, that you can't just park all willy-nilly and
There is a park just down below the Peterborough Lift Lock, so you can park at the park, put in there, and then paddle up.
Yep. Plan ahead. Decide where you will launch your canoe and kayak in order to reach the event. Access for this event is from the bottom of the Peterborough Lift Lock only, not the top. So when the one tub gets to the top, they don't open the doors so that people can go out and people can come in.
They're going
to
lift you up and drop
They'll
you
lift
back
you
down.
Up, then they drop you back down. There will be no parking available at the Peterborough Lift Lock or Peterborough Lift Lock Visitor Center, except for vehicles with accessible parking permits. A paddlecraft drop-off option is available at the Peterborough Lift Lock Visitor Center for beginner paddlers only. Paddlecraft must be transported to the water from the parking lot. There's entertainment and activities on site. Live music, kids zone, yoga sessions, water safety, Lions Club barbecue, giant games, boating safety booth for Boating Ontario, and a water truck and temporary restroom facilities will be on site. So you don't need to worry about that.
Cool.
For the best experience, we recommend entering the canal from Little Lake. And that's what we've done before. Yep. If you choose this route, you'll paddle through Lock 20 Ashburnham. So you launch into the lake, you come around, you go through the first lock, which adds an extra 30 to 60 minutes, depending on how busy.
But that's all part of the fun.
Yeah. Then you continue to the Peterborough Lift Lock, which takes around 20 more minutes. To save time, you can portage around Lock 20 before paddling Lock 21 or enter the water closer to Lock 21. So when we did it, we parked, paddled the little lake, went through the lift lock, paddled up, and then we were able to find a spot where we could tie off to the shore and the side of the canal and jump out and go see people that we knew, go check out some of the events, that sort of stuff.
Yep.
And Bob's your uncle. You just definitely got to find out where you can park and stuff like that. Rules and requirements. All ages and skill levels are welcome. No stand-up paddle boards. No inflatable vessels, stand-up paddle boards, kayaks, or otherwise. All paddlers and passengers must wear PFD in order to participate. Smoke-free and cannabis-free event. Alcohol-free event. Pets on boats are not encouraged. Respect your fellow paddlers. Visitors who do not follow the rules and requirements will not be permitted to enter the tubs. Note, this is a rain or shine event. Dress for the weather, canoe or kayak. So some of the things you need, canoe, kayak, personal flotation device for each paddler, sound signaling device, buoyant heaving line, bailer for each boat, watertight flashlight, sunscreen and a hat, and a water bottle.
Standard rules apply.
Right. The Rideau Canal starts at 2 p.m. After a hugely successful event in 2024, we're thrilled to bring paddlers together once again to celebrate the historic Rideau Canal. Be part of a story 193 years in the making as you experience the beauty of this UNESCO World Heritage Site from the water. Paddle into the lock alongside a flash mob of colorful canoes and kayaks and descend through the locks to the sounds of laughter and music.
People are going to be laughing at you?
Probably. There is no visitor parking at the lock station for this event. Participants may drive to the Hartwell's visitor parking and drop off their equipment at the check-in area. From there, nearby parking is available at the Experimental Farm and Carleton University Lot P18 parking garage. Fees do apply for those. Or participants may drive to the gravel parking lot at 588 Hogs Back Road, where they can park and launch their paddle craft. From there, the paddle towards the Hogs Back lock station, where Parks Canada staff will be waiting to lock you and your group down. Once you are through, make your way north towards the festivities at Hartwell's. Give yourself 20 minutes to paddle from Hogs Back to Hartwell's. Staff at Hogs Back will wait for a number of paddlers to arrive before locking you through. If you do not want to wait, you have the option to portage around.
Perfect.
Plan to arrive at Hartwell's by 2. Know your timing. Locking through can take up to an hour. Though a portage option is now available. Allow 20 minutes to paddle from Hogs Back to Hartwell's. Lock and paddle will begin at 2:30. Once enough participants have assembled in the top lock at Hartwell's, we will start our group lockages. And how it will work is all participants will gather at the top. Once the lock is full, the descent will commence. Paddlers will then transfer into the bottom lock because it's a two-lock system. They'll transfer the bottom lock. While the bottom lock is filling, the top lock will refill with the next group. Double lockage. All participants will exit at the bottom of the lock into the Ottawa lock's reach, where the options will be portage back up the hill or wait in your vessel for upbound lockages.
There you go.
Same rules and regs as the Peterborough lift lock.
Standard rules apply.
And the Lachine Canal starts at 1 o'clock. San Gabriel lock number 3 of the Lachine Canal. Starting at 12:30 p.m., drop off your watercraft at the dock located at 31 Mill Street in Montreal. Or, starting at 1 p.m., you may access the designated event landing stage at Atwell Market to drop off your watercraft before parking your vehicle. Locking process, 2:30 to 3, entry into the lock. 3 till 3:15, lock gates close and official photo session. 3:15 to 3:45, downstream locking process for all participants. 3:45 to 4:15, exit for participants heading towards Peel. Participants who launched at Atwell must remain in the lock.
Atwater.
What did I say?
Atwell.
Oh, Atwater. Sorry, I'm looking at five different things. 4:15 to 4:45, upstream locking process, and then exit for participants heading to Atwater. Or Atwell. 5:15 p.m. End of event. Return your watercraft to the landing stage. Retrieve your vehicle and return to pick up your watercraft. Same rules and requirements as the Peterborough lift lock. Parks.canada.ca. In their little search bar, put lock and paddle 2025. It'll take you to all the pages and you'll get a lot more information and maps and everything you need to know about doing lock and paddle 2025. I was thinking probably do the Peterborough lift lock, but I got a message from our buddy John that says, how about a road trip to Ottawa?
Yeah.
So I might go to Ottawa.
That sounds fun.
And do the Rideau Canal locks. We'll have to see how that goes.
Yeah, it'd be neat to do it at a different location. And it's very well organized. As it is every year, it's a fun event. And just like Canada 150, when all the lockages were free, they're going to be free again this year.
Yeah.
And also, even if it wasn't free this year, it's free because of the lock and paddle. So they're not charging people to participate. So it's very cool. It's a very neat event. I did it once. You've done it a couple times. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Well, if we go to Ottawa, I can maybe hit up my brother for some food at his restaurant.
Yes, there you go.
But we know people in the Ottawa area as well, so they may join in too. So make it a big a big do. But you know who won't be there?
Me.
You. And why won't you be there?
Because on that day, I will be probably in Grand Falls, New Brunswick.
Right? So.
Working my way back home.
Up your nose with a rubber hose.
Working my way back home. Was that? Yes, up my nose with a rubber hose.
Up your nose with a rubber hose. All right, looks like fun. So we learned a lot of things this week.
We have.
Meteo tsunamis, dogs paddling. For platypus extinction. Rangers are patrolling the Mackenzie River again. Mackenzie from the Great Slave up to Tuktoyaktuk. That'd be a good trip.
So I was looking at that route the other day. I came across a video. They talked about the Smoking Hills, which is 400 kilometers east of Tuk. And when I first saw it, it's like, oh, that's neat. So I went to Google Maps and I started pulling up photos because people plant photos in the area, right? So there's a group of guys that were paddling in the area. So you click on it and it's like you could see there on the edge of that. It's right on the edge of the Arctic Ocean is this, it's like an old river, an outlet. And plus there's the Mackenzie that goes up there as well. And it's just amazing to look at. Have you ever heard of the Smoking Hills?
No.
So the Smoking
I know there's the ones down in Kentucky, but those are like mines that have been on fire, like coal mines that have been on fire forever.
So this here is a combination of different minerals that periodically just flash on fire. And so the hills themselves are kind of, it's a mineral burn. It's the chemicals that are in the ground. So they call it the Smoking Hills. And it's like, I want to go there. I'd have to run the Mackenzie River to get down there. And so me and Siobhan were looking at it. It's like, if we could get up to Tuk, we could paddle around. And so I did a measurement and it's like, that's 400 kilometers one way to the Smoking Hills. that's not going to happen.
That's the thing is you always look, that's not that far. And then when you start really like, looking.
Oh, wait, that is far.
Yeah, that's not an afternoon.
But it would be neat to get up there and see the Smoking Hills and see, like, if you look at the map on Google Maps, you can see where people have planted some photos. When you do the street view, there's photo view as well.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very nice photos. A lot of them are people that working in the area, everything's by helicopter. So there's a lot of helicopter shots of ice and snow and then a few canoeists up there in the summer. So it's neat to daydream about canoeing in the area and along that coast.
Right. Can't wait till I retire.
I know. Long drive up to Tuk and then paddle the coast.
At that point, who cares?
Yeah.
Right? And then you sleep in your truck or something.
Yep.
Like I've never had to do that before. Alrighty, you got anything else, Dad?
I do not.
Well, okie dokie. Well, if you want to find more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream our episodes at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. If you go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.